If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. And before we introduce today's guest, I just want to point out I've been kind of tracking how the podcast is going. And I've been amazed and astonished and flattered. We have listeners actually all over the world. We had somebody tune in from Tonga recently, which is just phenomenal to me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate everybody who's listening to the podcast, watching it on YouTube, contacting me through the website with your comments or suggestions. It's just been great. I really appreciate it. Today, we're lucky because we have an in-person guest who came into the studio to talk to us, somebody I've known for many years. Our guest today is Kathy Ponting. She's a former lieutenant with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which used to be known as the California Department of Fish and Game. She spent many years there as a uniformed officer and ended her career as the lieutenant overseeing their special operations unit, which we'll talk about today. Really happy to have her here. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us. I'm glad to have you.
Thank you, Ed. I'm happy to be here, too.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we saw each other on the job.
On surveillance.
Yeah, exactly. Last time we worked together, we were doing surveillance in Los Angeles. That's right. Yeah. So, since you retired, you're doing something really cool that's still involved with wildlife conservation. Just tell us a little bit about what you're doing now with marine mammals.
Yeah, I volunteer for the Marine Mammal Center. I've been there for 9 years, and it's a wonderful nonprofit that our rescue range is from the Oregon border down to Santa Barbara. And we are involved in the rescue, rehab, and release of all the marine mammals that we have along our California coast. And a lot of different things happen to them, and we learn from them, too. I was telling you earlier, they're sentinels of the sea. They're telling us what's going on out in our oceans. And we have our main research hospital up in Sausalito, which is just an amazing place if you're ever up there. They have guided tours, and it's pretty amazing. You can see all the animals that we're rehabbing. My facility's in Morro Bay. We're a satellite ER hospital, basically, and we do a little bit of settling of the animals, and they eventually make it up to our main hospital.
That is awesome. I love how so many people who are involved in our profession, you know, they retire from conservation law enforcement and then they go do something else related to conservation. It's just in our blood, I think, you know.
It is. And what I liked about this, it was completely different. I didn't get to work very closely with pinnipeds during our investigations. And it's interesting to learn about these seals and sea lions and sea otters. And they're pretty amazing critters. And we really try to keep them around for the future.
The other thing I love about you, Kathy, is, you know, you're a second generation game warden. Your dad was a game warden for the California Department of Fish and Game.
Yes.
And now your daughter is also a game warden.
Yes, she is.
Which is just incredible. You had three generations of
very proud mama.
Yeah, that's very cool. So let's talk a little bit about your career. I mentioned you were a uniformed game warden for a while, but you ended your career as a plainclothes officer, a lieutenant, overseeing the Special Operations Unit. We've had other guests on who've worked for California SOU, Savannah, our great plant case.
Yay,
that we
Savannah.
Had. Yay, Savannah in season one. But can you tell us a little bit about, you know, give us a short description of what SOU was like when you were working there? And as the leader of that unit, you know, how did it operate?
Well, I think I was there at a good time. Our state budget was healthy. We had, during the 12 years that I was on special ops full time, we had anywhere from 10 to 11 officers on the team. And that was the unique thing about our special ops is we worked as a team. Mm-hmm. We were pretty much doing the investigations and surveillances and the covert work as a team.
So it's a team of like 10 and 12 people. That's a big team.
It is.
That's unusual. Kind of most states might have a plainclothes unit or a special operations unit, but they probably don't have 10 or 12 officers. In that setup, were you guys working always together? Or would you split off and work on your own cases? How did that work?
We usually were together. Sometimes we would split the team. If we had a couple investigations going on simultaneous, we always had several cases going on. But, you know, using personnel correctly, time management, sometimes if we had enough people to go and do a surveillance, we would split the team. We would try to work a couple cases at a time. But for the most part, we were together most of the time, which required a lot of good people skills because you're basically living with your team.
And I have to say, during my career as a special agent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife based in L.A., I had a lot of opportunities to work with you specifically and your team. And I was always extremely impressed with the quality of, law enforcement professionalism among your specific team of wardens. And one of the things I was always impressed by was your skill at what I call rolling surveillance, which is you're following somebody who's on the move. And you guys were invisible. You were extremely skilled at that technique. And did you think that just came from working together for so long, or did you specifically train to do that and constantly train?
I think
train?
Both, Ed. Mm. I was fortunate to have the same core team for almost a decade.
That helps.
We would have some wardens come and go for various reasons. It's really hard on your personal life.
Yeah.
You're on the road all the time. You're living out of your van or your truck. It's not always glamorous, but I had the same core team and we could finish each other's sentences. That's how close we were. And we focused on people's strengths and what they knew how to do well. And we just knew how to operate. So when we went into surveillance mode, it was like a dance. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just something we were used to. The team was very good at it. We were very successful. And there's strength in numbers when it comes to surveillance. And I do understand that it's a huge challenge for other states because they don't have a team that big. You can still do really good surveillance with a handful of people, but probably more short term, and it is a lot more challenging.
And it's in a state like California, where you have very dense urban, situations, neighborhoods, and you also have extreme remote open areas, the skill set or the techniques that you use on a rolling surveillance in a city like Los Angeles or San Francisco, it's very different than how you run it if you're out along the coast, a single two-lane highway along the coast or in the, backcountry. And so it's not just a single skill set. It's like multiple skill sets within a skill set, right?
We are always having to figure out, when a lot of times we'd start in a rural environment and we'd have to use a certain technique for rural environments, which is the most challenging surveillance you can put a team into. And then we would roll into a large urban, just like what I drove in yesterday, the traffic of LA or San Francisco or Sacramento. And it's a completely different technique. It's a lot easier, but it's also traffic can be a nuisance.
Yes.
And can get in your way.
It can trap you. Yeah,
yes.
It can trap you and mail. When I worked in LA, we did a lot of surveillance in LA. So our team got pretty good at the urban surveillance. Mm-hmm. I think only once in my career did I do an extended one, and that was down to San Diego. So you're still on, you're on I-5, so you got lots of lanes to kind of lose your cover team in. But yeah, real challenge. And your team was really excelled at it. I was always very impressed by that. Some of the, you worked on different types of cases. And the other thing I noticed when I would work with you guys is you tended to focus on problem areas. Like you would identify a problem area or a species that was under a lot of pressure, and you would focus your time and energy on that particular issue, which, you know, a uniformed warden wouldn't necessarily have time to do that because they have patrol duties and all kinds of other things, right?
It's a different life.
Yeah, it's a different life, and it's a hardcore group of people, right? So it's a very hardcore group of people. One of the species that the your unit worked on a lot during your time was a marine species called abalone.
That's correct.
Yeah, my listeners in South Africa will know that as abalone. That's what they call it, abalone, but same critter. Can you tell us a little bit what is abalone? Where is it found, and why was it a species of concern when you were working, and what's its current situation? Yeah.
What is it about this abalone anyway?
Yeah,
it's an amazing species. It's not cute and fuzzy, you know, like working bears or deer or, you know, anything, bobcat. But it's such an important resource to California. And the north coast of California was one of the last viable red abalone populations in the entire world. You know, there's not abalone spread out all over the world. You've got South Africa, you've got New Zealand, British Columbia, California, little bits of Oregon and Mexico. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and it's not the entire coastlines either, right?
No,
like South Africa, it's pretty much limited to the Western Cape there, and California, it's more northern, right?
Well, it does, you know, we do have populations down in the Channel Islands, which is off the coast of Santa Barbara, LA, Ventura. And then it goes down into Mexico, and this type of species changes. So yes, but the north coast is where the red abalone were, and the red abalone are one of the largest abalone in the world.
And what is it though? Like an abalone, what kind of animal is this?
It's a marine snail. I wish I could describe it as a little more flattering, but it's a marine snail, and their shells are beautiful. Their shells, the inside of their shells, are beautiful green, blue, iridescent. And a lot of times they're made into jewelry, and they're very decorative. That is just a byproduct of the abalone. The target is for the meat. It's a delicacy. It's caught up in the whole traditional Chinese medicine arena. Aphrodisiac, considered an aphrodisiac, and also gives status to those who are capable. And to harvest them.
Yeah, what's the process for harvesting?
It's mostly diving. We used to have a commercial industry in California, and there was about 84 dive boats permitted, and they would use hookah gear, which is surface air supplied with hoses.
Right.
With the big regulators, masks type things, and they would harvest. We had to close the season in 1997 because of the collapse of the stock, which was only allowed between the Farallon Islands and the Channel Islands.
Okay.
The North Coast was always protected with just sport take only. So on a very minus tide, one who is not a diver could go out and rock pick because they're exposed. I mean, they're a snail. They're adhered to the rocks. They can move.
Right.
They
but do. They're slow movers.
They're very slow. I could catch it. But most people would dive, and the regulations were absolutely no scuba. It was only breath hold, free diving only.
Okay.
And the reason behind that was that limits the depths that people can go to harvest. And the deep water stocks were considered our refuge stocks.
So the commercial trade though was shut down in the 90s, and that so all that was left really was what you called a sport which would be you or me could get some type of fishing license to go out and collect, and that would be using this breath holding technique. And presumably that was for my own use. Like, I'm going to eat this, or I'm going to,
exactly.
My family's going to eat it. Right. So at that point, was commercial completely illegal?
Yes. So after the close of the 84 to 100 permitted commercial divers, it was just sport take, and no fish or game taken under a sport fishing license or a hunting license can be legally sold.
Gotcha. Okay. So commercialization is prohibited under sport
exactly.
take any, of
exactly.
any species. Interesting. You mentioned there's a couple interesting things about these snails, these abalone. What are they, like, when they're out there, what are they eating? What is an abalone?
Solely kelp. And specifically bull kelp.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, off the coast of California, there are huge kelp beds. Kelp forests is actually what they're called. Habitat to a lot of different species, but interesting. Okay, so they eat exclusively kelp. And you mentioned that they're still, they're important kind of in the, for different reasons, for food, Chinese medicine, traditional medicine, all these other things you mentioned. I didn't even know. I didn't know they were used as an aphrodisiac. What's their, like, is there a temptation to commercialize abalone?
They're so highly sought after on the black market, Ed.
Why though?
Just for those reasons, really? I told you, the beliefs, and they're a delicacy too. They taste amazing. You asked me earlier what abalone tastes like. Abalone tastes like abalone. I can't even compare it to anything else. Okay. I mean, I used to die for abalone. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and one of my favorite foods. But they just highly sought after on the black market. One red abalone can sell for $100.
Wow.
In the city or Chinatown or wherever they happen to take them.
So the temptation is there for
monetary reasons
to people to poach these abalone in high numbers, I assume too, right? With the sport fishery, I assume there's a limit on how many you
very highly fish. Regulated. Yeah. I mean, before we had to end up closing the sport season in 2018, and we'll talk about those reasons later, but I think it was down to 3 abalone a day and 8 annually.
That's what you could take if you were a sport fisherman.
Through the years that I was working abalone cases, it just became more conservative with regulations as the time went on because they weren't doing very well.
Yeah, so it became kind of an important issue for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Game.
It was one of the focused species that they wanted us to work on, that and sturgeon and some other species, but abalone was pretty much at the top of the list.
Okay. It's kind of a perfect example of how law enforcement can play a role in either slowing, stopping, or reversing the decline of certain species. You know, we've seen it again and again from stories from people who come talk to us on this podcast about how they got involved in protecting, you know, highly endangered species. And it really illustrates kind of the role of law enforcement in stopping the decline or trying to stop the decline in certain species. And your unit certainly has some fascinating cases that they got into with regard to abalone, which we're going to talk about a little bit. One of the things I think you mentioned to me is abalone is kind of known as, what do they call it? It's called Pacific gold. That's how valuable it is, right?
Pacific gold. They would go and take a withdrawal from the Bank of the Pacific.
A withdrawal that does not earn a lot of interest, right? Because it's not growing itself. Okay, so let's talk about one of these cases a little bit. You have one you wanted to talk about that's kind of an interesting illustration. There was a particular case you worked on related. A couple of individuals were involved in abalone poaching for commercial purposes. What was that case? Tell us a little bit about how that case started and how you got onto it.
So the team, we travel all over the United States. United States, well, that too, but mostly California. Yeah. We're responsible for all the commercial illegal commercial cases throughout the state. So we're on the road a lot. Yeah. We're gone a lot. And we would had, and sometimes we would take a break like in December for a couple weeks around the holidays. And we were all on break, planning to be off for a couple weeks, which was much needed. And we get a, all of us start getting phone calls on our state phones and our home offices one night that we've received some information. This was from the lieutenant at the time. Pretty specific information that an informant had given to one of our uniformed officers, which, by the way, we worked very close with our uniform officers. They were the boots on the ground. They're the ones that knew what was happening in their district.
Right.
We got most of our amazing information from them, and such as this case.
Yeah, I think those special units, you know, special investigative units or special operations units, if they don't work seamlessly with the more routine, like patrol-oriented or routine investigative-oriented officers, they are just, they're hamstringing themselves, yeah, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Hamstringing yourself. Yeah, you're cutting off an amazing resource that, why?
Right.
I mean, so we worked very close with our uniform squads in the areas wherever we were working.
Well, it led to a tip on this case, right?
It did. This warden got a very specific tip that this gentleman named John had been running up to the North Coast on a regular basis, poaching abalone and coming back and selling them. And the his name did not ring a bell to any of us. Mm. It was like, whoa, he's not on our radar, but that's some very specific information.
Right.
And plus, he's leaving within the next few days again. It was obviously, it was definitely a woman scorned that gave us that information, but hey, we're rolling with it.
Some of the best tips come from, we've always said, yeah. Ex-wives, ex-girlfriends, ex-boyfriends, ex-husbands will give you the best tips.
So we get this call, and it's dark, it's in the evening, and we are all rolling, and in Santa Cruz, this is in Santa Cruz, California, where it's occurring, and our team lives all over.
Right.
Because we come together every week, and we don't know where we're ever going to be.
Right.
I mean, it depends on the information I get, and I'll put out what's called the week ahead. This is what we're planning on doing. And our motto that we lived and died by was plan on doing what you didn't plan on doing. That was how we lived. And this was a perfect example. So we are rolling to Santa Cruz, California. We're all there the next morning. And we're briefing on the information that we have, and we know what to do. We know, okay, we need to set up our surveillance team. So I was the one that was point on the suspect's house, and the rest of the team is just off in the wind, and, you know, we're communicating on direct channels. And for the first couple of hours, I was just reporting on the sheer boredom because nothing was going on,
right,
which is typical. And then a couple hours later, this red van pulls into the driveway. This John, who we identify later as John, gets out, opens the hatch, starts covering the back hatch with tarps, puts in a duffel bag, a backpack, and he jumps in and he takes off.
Okay.
So now we're going to do what we do well. Yeah. We're going to follow this guy. We're thinking we're just following John.
Mm.
Well, he goes into old Santa Cruz, pulls up to a house, and by this time we have another one of our officers on point. Point person's not always the same person. It's wherever you end up.
Right.
And he's like, wow, this place looks really familiar. And John was just sitting in the van, and out walks Joel.
Mm.
And we recognize Joel, carrying two scuba tanks. And Joel Roberts was a ex-commercial abalone diver, very famous. Him and his partner had the fishing vessel Deeper Blue. They were infamous for just being these good-looking blonde surfers, and they worked hard, and they dove the Farallon Islands, which is the breeding ground of the great white. So they were kind of glorified in what they did.
They were abalone cowboys, kind of.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were. And they were both really into surfing, and they also used their boat out at Mavericks to tow some of the famous surfers out. And he was, anyways. So it was like, oh my gosh. And we had heard rumblings. And this is 3 years after the close of the commercial season.
Okay. Early 2000s.
Early 2000. So this is, we're like, okay, this is really getting interesting. Mm-hmm. So Joel jumps in the van and they start heading north. And sure enough, we're immediately going up. We're in Santa Cruz. So we're in, next thing we know, we're headed towards Sonoma County. Well, after we get into the San Francisco area, they make this left turn onto Gary Boulevard, which is kind of the Sunset District and just not where you would dive for abalone. We're like, okay, something's going on here.
Yeah.
And he pulls in and parks next to this rickety old storage shack that had double doors on it and locked with a hasp. He gets out of the car and he looks left and right and he keys himself in and he leaves it ajar. And one of our other officers was in a great point position and he could see that he opens a big chest freezer. So we know this is a cold storage area.
Okay.
So we think, okay, this is really getting interesting. All he comes out was 5 gallon bucket. So jumps back in the car, goes to a dive shop in Marin County, gets 2 airfills in his tanks. And we're like, okay, let's go. And we get into Sonoma County, stop at Kmart. Are those even open anymore?
Yeah, Kmart's gone.
Come out with these 4 huge totes.
Okay.
So we know they're serious.
Yeah, this tip you got's looking pretty good.
It's looking really good.
Yeah.
So we're kind of ready to roll, and they just go north a little ways and pull into Motel 6, get their room, key themselves into room 28. And shut the blinds. There we sit.
Yeah.
That's the nature. The hurry up and wait, the boredom. You've got to stick with it. You know what's going to happen. You're always going to have somebody on point. You might switch people out. At some point, people have to sleep. That was another one of our mottos. We can sleep when we're dead. So we watched it and watched it and watched it. And we also knew, unfortunately, that Joel had a very serious heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. So we knew that this was probably a lot that fueled his activities. Mm,
so he may be involved in abalone poaching to make money for his drug habit.
Yes.
Wasn't there another connection Joel had to like abalone conservation or something like that? Did you know about that at the time?
Yes, we did know about this. He was selected to be on the Abalone Advisory Committee of the State of California while he was a diver, and I think he still was on it after the commercial season closed, that it was a group of people from all different walks of all things abalone that made suggestions on how to enhance the populations, how to spend the landing tax from the commercial industry wisely to help enhance the populations, and it was a conservation type thing to help these populations because it's always struggled.
Unbelievable.
Because they're so slow growing. Did we even talk about that?
No, we didn't talk about their growth.
They're a very slow growing creature. Mm. They're a broadcast spawner, which means the eggs and the sperm are released into the water column and they have to be in very close proximity to have a successful propagation. So everything about abalone makes their populations very fragile.
Right.
So that was a slap in the face to us.
Yeah.
You know, that was like, really?
But also a motivator because, you know, you get somebody who you suspect is violating, who's also, you know,
Taking full advantage.
Yeah, taking full advantage. They're on a conservation advisory committee. They're holding themselves out as an abalone conservationist, and you know they're violating. That's a motivator for a law enforcement officer. That person would have gone to the top of my list.
Yes, and he was definitely on the top of our list as he walked out of his door with dive tanks in his hands.
So you have to sit on them now because they're at the hotel, but eventually they do go out and poach, right?
Yeah, a little after midnight. Door opens, they quickly walk out, jump in the van. And, you know, we wanted to be real careful because it could have been a junk food run, you know, who knows? So we're very careful on our surveillance techniques and knowing who he is and how close he worked with Fish and Wildlife and being a commercial diver. This guy's good at what he does.
Right.
So he was going to be an extreme challenge to stay with undetected.
Right.
He's got a lot to lose. So we start headed to the coast and we realize once he gets to our normal route to, you know, the coastal beaches of Sonoma County, we know we're on a run. So we're being very careful because we're on Lonely Highway 1 in the middle of the night. And that is a surveillance team's nightmare.
Nightmare. Headlights are seen for miles.
We are the only ones out there.
Unusual.
With this guy that is just a radar detector for surveillance. So it was a huge challenge. So we worked our techniques the way we do. Don't have to really go into all that detail.
Don't reveal secrets.
So we end up losing his light. So we suspected that he had stopped in this particular area. It's called Fisk Mill, if anybody's familiar with Sonoma County. And this whole coastline is just epic dive areas.
Okay. So these guys aren't going on boats. They go down to the beach and they take their dive gear straight out into the water.
Right.
Okay. And they can find an abalone right there.
Oh, yeah. Most abalone are very close.
Okay.
Close to the surface. That's why rock pickers can get them at a low tide.
At a low tide.
So I happen to be right behind them at the moment in the area that we think they went. I think they go into the Fisk Mill parking lot, which is on the west side of Highway 1, and maybe he's going to get dropped off. So I go up this other road, Cruz Ranch Road, very windy, beautiful dirt road with some cabins, seasonal cabins up there, to get a vantage, to turn around and get a vantage with night vision to see if he's in this parking lot. And I come around a corner not too far off of Highway 1, and there's the van. Hatch open, Joel at the back of it, holding a wetsuit.
Oh, shit.
Trying to sneak around the side of the van and close the hatch so whoever this person is in this van won't see him. So I just told the crew, I says, hey, here he is. They're up here. I'm out of it.
You're out.
My van is toasty. Yeah. So I'm going to keep going and just get out of this surveillance for right now. And I went up and pulled into a remote driveway from a summer cabin that was unoccupied.
So what did he do? Like, did he then give up for the night? Cause he'd been seen by either. I assume he didn't think you were a cop at that point or a warden.
I don't think he thought Fish and Game, but some citizen saw him with a wetsuit.
Yeah, they might
at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, at the back of a hatch of across the street from one of the best dive areas on the Sonoma coast. Yeah.
Did he give up then that night, or what did he do?
Did.
Uh-huh.
So we have our team spread out, tucked in north and south, and within 5 minutes, the team sees him headed southbound.
Okay.
And they could tell there was still two people in the car.
Right.
Our officers were able to see that when they drove by. So we're like, okay, maybe he's going to go somewhere else. Cause Sonoma coast is big.
Right.
Maybe he's going to check another place down south. So we super loose tail all the way into Jenner, all the way into Guerneville, back into Petaluma, back into room 28 at the Motel 6. And now it's like,
The exciting world of law enforcement. Yeah, exciting world of a game warden in SAU.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's dynamic and flattering. Yeah, it can be just.
Right.
So.
But he doesn't give up now.
No,
like a good crook would be like, oh, I've been seen. I better not. But no, he's out there to get abalone and earn money. What did he? Eventually,
yeah, he was probably questioning himself. Who knows? I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in that room 28. But so we don't know if he's going to try a daytime run.
Right.
It's December, which is the sports season's closed. So Cover of Darkness is going to be the safest MO.
There's no legal abalone.
Safest technique.
Okay.
So here we go. So we made the decision, the least tired person was going to take point, and everybody else, and one other person would stay there, and everybody else went in, they're always sleazy motels, into the sleazy motel across the street to try to get some sleep, because we don't know what he's going to do.
Right.
So that's 4 in the morning. 11 o'clock that night.
Oh, boy.
The door opens, and we start this all over again. And, you know, we have rotated people through the hotel rooms trying to get some sleep. And we're doing pretty good now. So they jump in their van, and they take off. And, you know, when something doesn't work, you've got to do something different. Mm-hmm. So we use another technique, John was his lookout, so that's next to impossible to actually watch him dive.
Right, I was going to say.
Even with night vision.
He's got a driver who's dropping him off.
Right.
Going to keep an eye out.
Yeah, so that's not going to work. So we're like, okay, we have to seal him in or at least be able to prove that if he does harvest, that he know which county to prosecute him in.
Right.
So since my van was toasty, I just flew ahead of everybody and got to the Sonoma-Mendocino County line in the little town of Gualala, which is an amazing little town. Backed my van in a bunch, you know, by the grocery store and gas station and just kind of secreted myself there and just watched that road. Because if he does cross into Mendocino, we need to know that.
Right.
So he never did.
Okay.
And then we had our southern units just Wade and Jenner. I mean, all spread out, hidden. And probably about 7 in the morning, here they come, past our officers in Jenner. So we could say they stayed in Sonoma County.
Okay.
Because on Highway 1, to get anywhere else into Mendocino County, you'd have to go all the way back into Highway 101. Right. Makes no sense.
So you basically know that between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m., they were out doing something.
Yeah.
In that county. Okay. How'd you figure out what they were doing?
So,
this is crazy.
When we get back to the motel, they go back upstairs. I walk by the back of the van, which, by the way, was a rental van. And that's another technique. They always rent vehicles. They don't always. Poachers mostly rent vehicles because, number one, if you run the plate, it doesn't come back registered to anybody in particular that you can identify. And number two, we have had huge success in vehicle forfeitures.
Yeah, can't forfeit.
So they don't want their cars forfeited. So this is rented from Rent a Wreck. I swear to God, it really was called that.
Okay.
And now I can see those 4 totes that were stacked inside each other, empty with all the lids in the top tote, all laid out side by side with a sleeping bag rolled over.
Interesting. Okay.
Thrown over it. And Joel's wet dive gear.
Okay.
Still in the back. So we're like, okay.
Now, interesting. This is an interesting law enforcement point here. There's no reasonable expectation of privacy in a vehicle that somebody can walk by and look in the window.
Oh, absolutely.
So you don't need a warrant to walk by a vehicle
warrant.
And look in the window.
You're in a public place. Anybody can look in there.
Exactly.
You're right. No expectation of privacy.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Classic. Great technique to use. Yeah.
Yeah. We were lucky it didn't have tinted windows because we could see very well.
Yeah.
So a couple hours later, they come downstairs. I'm surprised they didn't head out right away, but probably needed a fix or something, but they take off south, headed back towards San Francisco, and we're still being very conservative on our surveillance. And, you know, we're getting into more traffic, so it's easier. So we head over the Golden Gate Bridge. He makes a hard right into the Presidio. I don't know if you're familiar with San Francisco.
Yeah.
And he starts doing cleanup maneuvers.
Interesting. And cleanup, by that you mean like counter-surveillance, right?
Counter-surveillance.
So he's looking to see if he's got a tail.
So
What sort of things would he do?
Pulling over to the side of the road, pulling down into a dead-end street and turning around and waiting, and just watching everybody that's going by. And at this particular location, he was very close to that old cold storage shed, remember we talked about?
Right.
So we think that he hadn't necessarily picked up on our surveillance, but he was doing his counter-surveillance because he was getting ready to land.
Okay.
So they continue on, and they start getting, they're back on Gary Boulevard, headed towards 26th Avenue, which is where this little shed is. And all of a sudden, the van stops in the middle of, I don't know if you're familiar with some of those San Francisco streets, but they are so busy, and there's pedestrians everywhere. They stop in the middle of the street. Joel's passenger, he jumps out, runs across the street, and starts walking down Gary Boulevard. And we had already, two of us had already parked our surveillance vehicles just a little bit to the west of where they, ahead of where they pulled over.
Right.
Just was good timing. He walked right in front of our vans.
Wow.
You know, head on a swivel, looking around. And we jump out, you know, we get geared up. Because at this point, we know what we're going to do. I should back up a little bit.
Yeah,
the rest of the team stops John in the van.
You make a traffic stop.
Yes.
Okay.
And that everything's right there. And John gives consent to get in the back.
Wow. Okay.
And they those totes are loaded.
Loaded with abalone.
And shucked abalone too, which is really unfortunate because most of the time that we seize abalone in the shell, they can survive a day or two out of water. And it was our policy because there was a handful of us that were state divers. So we would take that evidence abalone, photograph it, document it, and we would dive and
put it back,
replace them on the reefs.
That's awesome.
It's that valuable.
Right.
Because no judge wants that pile of abalone sitting in his courtroom.
Right.
And
plus, you're going to save it.
And the exactly. And all the prosecutors totally agreed with that. So we know we have, I think it was 129 abalone. Yes. And these red abalone are very large. And he's a very good diver. And so myself and the lieutenant, he ducks around a corner and we are right after him. And he's sucked up against the wall.
Joel.
Just knowing that the look on his face was like, oh, yeah. Here it is. Here's the day.
Interesting. I wonder if at the last minute they had suspected you were behind them.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible.
But how many abalone were in that truck?
129.
And you said they're worth how much a piece at that
$100
time?
$100 a piece.
Wow. Okay. That's a big load.
So that's $1,300.
Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah, I'm sorry. I'm kind of getting us off track. You bust Joel right there and you've taken it down, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had suspected who his buyer was.
Uh-huh.
And when he was a commercial diver, there was a man named Jimmy Fong who owned Goldmine Seafood, Pier 45, Embarcadero, San Francisco, that was an import-export fish dealer. And he bought a lot of the abalone and shipped them to China. And it was apparent that after the commercial season closed that Jimmy and Joel still had the same commitment to each other. Hmm. It was business as usual, status quo. I'm going to go get you some abs, sell them to you, and you export them.
Interesting. Okay.
So we really wanted Jimmy Fong too. So Joel had left his cell phone in the van And as our officers are inventorying the van and getting the tow truck and everything, the phone starts ringing off the wall, and it's Jimmy Fong.
Jimmy Fong, nice.
So one of our officers answers it, trying to sound like Joel.
Wow, nice.
You not here, where are you? And he's trying to play it off, and you don't sound like yourself, so he hangs up. And we come to find out that that shed belonged to Jimmy Fong.
Okay, so these guys were taking that load back to the shed that belonged to Jimmy Fong. Yeah. So they were, that sale was on. You just interrupted the sale just before.
Yeah.
Nice.
But the good thing about 129 abalone, that's evidence that over 12 is considered for commercial purposes.
Excellent. So better case, stronger penalty.
Yes.
More serious offense, yeah.
So we had done a lot of work in previous years to strengthen our penalty sections on a lot of this commercial poaching, especially abalone. Mm. And we got the penalties and fines increased to $40,000 for each violation, lifetime revocation, forfeiture of vehicles, boats, any equipment used in the commission of the crime, and we had felony conspiracy charges because they were working in conjunction with each other. So we did end up going to trial.
So who'd you charge? You ended up charging.
We charged Joel Roberts and John.
John, okay. What about Jimmy?
We did not have enough for Jimmy.
Okay.
It was a lot of circumstantial evidence, right. But we knew we didn't have him good enough to where he would be bound over to Superior Court in a preliminary hearing.
Before we get to the trial, though, the charges and trial on Joel and John, did you ever come up with any other evidence to suggest that this was not like a one-time deal?
Oh, yes. So as with any case we make, when you make an arrest, you're not done.
Right.
There's so much investigation to go, to get that bigger picture. We want that bigger picture. So seizing cell phones, doing cell phone search warrants and getting all that information. We interviewed the employees at Motel 6 in Petaluma.
Wow, good. That's good. That was smart.
Yeah, and it was a gold mine.
Yeah.
It wasn't Jimmy Fong's gold mine, but it was a gold mine.
Right.
They had records of Joel checking into Motel 6 like a couple times every week.
Interesting.
For months.
Wow. Okay, so you know what he's doing.
Yeah.
But presumably you couldn't necessarily charge him with extra counts because, yeah, you know what he was doing, but you can't prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Yeah, but this one ended up being enough.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
You got multiple counts on him.
Well, we had felony conspiracy to harvest abalone for commercial purposes.
Right.
And remember I told you the $40,000 fines, the jail time and stuff like that. We all had to testify at the preliminary hearing. And he was bound over to Superior Court, and we didn't go to jury trial. We actually ended up, there was a plea on that one.
Okay.
But the plea was good.
Okay.
This judge was not happy.
So Joel and John pled guilty?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
To this one
poaching
incident?
Yes.
Okay.
So Joel got 3 years in state prison.
Wow, that's a
Susanville
sentence.
State Prison.
That's a great sentence.
Yeah, it is a great sentence. Plus a lifetime revocation of licenses. Funky got, John Funky, he was his lookout.
Right.
He got like 200 some days county, substantial fine. But Joel went down pretty hard.
That's a great result. And, going back to what you discovered through the search warrants of the phones and interviewing the motel people, It showed that he had certainly done this before. You might not be able to charge those.
Right.
But, I think people kind of forget. Bad guys forget anyway. Sometimes maybe officers forget. Gathering that information can be used in sentencing.
Yes.
That can come up before a judge and say, well, Your Honor, we caught him here and he had done exactly the same MO, right?
Yes.
Same MO
And that's all spelled out in the report.
Yeah.
The dates, the times that he was up there.
Beautiful.
And it's shocking. It shocks the conscience of knowing. And if you did the math, I think we did the math on how many times he'd gone up there. He probably would have dove two nights. He probably would have used both. He did use both tanks. Hmm. He probably would have used both tanks, went and got an airfield. There's dive shops all up and down that area and gone out again. So he could have taken twice as many.
Yeah, if he hadn't got hinked up when he saw the vehicle that first night, and gone out that night and the second night, he would have doubled the amount.
Right.
Wow. And here's a guy who's on this conservation advisory group.
Abalone Advisory Committee for the state of California.
Shameful.
And what's really bad about scuba is, you know, you can stay down. He was a good diver. He could probably stay down an hour because you're not really that deep when, on some of these reefs. And he's just completely mowing down a reef. And remember I told you about broadcast spawning?
Yeah.
They need that proximity, you know, within a meter or two to be able to successfully propagate. So when you completely clean out a reef of all abalone, there's no reproduction going to ever go on again.
Right.
So...
Right.
It's just you've decimated that area.
Yeah. Shameful. You know, yeah. And you're separating, or even at best, you're starting to create more distance between individual abalone so that.
Yeah. That's the thing about broadcast spawning. You know, they're not going to be successful when it's.
And here's a guy who knew that, right? Because he knows abalone.
He knew that more than anybody.
Biology. And he. Still,
he was a very intelligent young man. Yeah.
Driven by...
And he was actually...
greed and his drug issues.
He was actually well-spoken, didn't resist. Mm. I mean, he wasn't a jerk.
Yes.
But, you know, he was... He made some really bad decisions in his personal life that drove him to have to do this. And, you know, you can't feel sorry for somebody like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not with the damage that they have done.
I agree. And he kind of never recovered. He had a drug problem. And
never recovered. Right? Unfortunately, he passed away at the age of 50, and he was 37 at the time we got him. Just the demons. He couldn't shake the demons.
So this obviously was not the only abalone case you worked successfully during your time. There's a lot of things impacting abalone. Certainly illegal poaching for commercial purposes doesn't help, right?
Right, right.
But at the same time, what are some of the other things that were going on with abalone? I mean, we can't, the elephant in the room, of course, is bigger factors, right?
Yes.
And it's climate change that's really impacting abalone, right?
Yes. So, you know, during my era with Special Ops, climate change was starting to be talked about, but it wasn't like we know it today. So we put our heart and soul into trying to keep this population viable. I mean,
and not just law enforcement, but the biologists, everybody that worked for California,
that have,
trying
you know,
hard, right?
That have done all the studying and the yes, it's just so much effort has gone into trying to save this population.
Right.
So have you ever heard of the blob?
No, and I wanted to talk to you about this because I had not heard about it before I talked to you.
They call it that. It's basically a marine heat wave that occurs out in the ocean. And in 2014, we had a huge one off the coast. I mean, it was massive. And in addition to that, in 2013, we started the sunflower sea stars started, they started dying from disease. Mm. And this is a whole chain of events. And we talked earlier about, I'm a firm believer that one ocean, one health, everything's connected.
Yeah, we've talked about that many times.
It's just, everything is so connected.
Right.
So the sea stars start dying off in mass quantities. And there are these, they're the large ones that just go over the ocean floor. The
starfish kind of what I would call starfish. So, yeah. But this is why are these dying off?
Diseases and this warming of the seas absolutely did not help. It makes them vulnerable, more susceptible to disease. I mean, it didn't just affect the sea stars. It affected all marine life.
Right. And this blob you're talking about is a blob of warm water.
Warm water.
It kind of moved into Northern California and sat, right?
Yes. I think it was more than Northern California, too. So these sea stars, this is the chain of event. These sea stars are the main predator of purple urchins.
Huh.
Purple urchins are very, remember we talked about abalone and their main diet is bull kelp?
Right.
North coast, usually just an amazing bull kelp forest. The sea stars are dying. The water is warming. It's this massive explosion of purple urchins, which are not the desirable red urchins that there was also a commercial industry for, because if you're a sushi eater, it's their gonads.
Okay.
And it's the uni that you have on. That's sea urchin.
Okay.
So the purple urchins explode. They occupy the same reefs as the abalone. They eat the same thing as the abalone.
Oh.
They eat through our north coast bull kelp. They deforest the bull kelp. Like 90% of our bull kelp was
gone.
Just completely devoured. So we have all the abalone that have starved to death, and now the purple urchins are starving to death. So you see that whole connection. You take out one species that controls another species that controls another species, and the next thing you know, you have this catastrophic collapse of such a valuable resource. And that's what we're faced with today. And, you know, we talked about glass half empty, glass half full, and I'm glass half full.
I'm glass half full myself,
yes,
too. So we got to figure this out, though. So these sea stars come in. The sea stars die. Purple urchins come in, eat all the bull kelp. That causes the abalone to starve to death. Abalone populations crash. Do you have kind of a sense on how much abalone populations have crashed?
Like I read from the department, like 94%.
94% of the abalone's
obliterated,
gone, basically.
Starved.
Wow. So glass half fullus. Kathy.
Well, we have a lot of big brains working on this. Mm. We have a lot of amazing scientists that have dedicated their lives to abalone, and they're trying everything they can. There was, and I don't know if they're still doing it, there was a big volunteer dive program where you could go out there and dive, and all you're doing is crushing purple urchins, just trying to, you know, eliminate them off the reef so the few abalone that are left have room and maybe some bull kelp will grow. There is another blob out there right now, apparently the size of North America.
Mm.
We'll see what happens with that. But we just have to keep going.
Yeah.
We just have to keep trying.
Yeah.
You can't because look at the history of some of the species that we thought we lost.
Right.
And we got them back.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of different various reasons, but I mean, this one's a daunting task, Ed.
Yeah.
But we can only hope.
You know, yeah, and species can be very resilient. I mean, the sad thing is I just saw today that there's a species of curlew in Europe that has been declared extinct as of, like, today. It's officially declared extinct. You know, and nobody really knows why. But on the other hand, we in the United States recovered our own bald eagle.
Right.
It was nearly extinct for a number of reasons. We've recovered the California condor,
right.
You know. Grizzly bears, buffalo, bison, whole host of
and those
species.
Were daunting tasks.
And those
we thought
were
we had lost
huge,
them.
Huge daunting tasks, cost us a lot of money. And so, yeah, you have to hope that species, you have to trust that species can be resilient and keep working to give them just that tiny bit of space that they might need to succeed, right?
Right.
And not give up hope. I think that's the biggest thing. And or even as you and I have talked about before, if you're going to be part of a lost cause, make sure it's a good cause or something like that.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, there are a lot of things that they're doing. They're trying to do a lot of aquaculture with kelp and things like that. And I think they've had some successes and failures. And, you know, you just got to keep working at it. And because it all really revolves around our kelp forest up there in that particular situation. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more species that rely on kelp forests as well. Sea otters.
It's not just the urchin and the and the abalone.
A lot of our favorite food fish require kelp forests to
breed
and survive.
And that's their habitat. That's their safe space, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. If anybody's ever dove through a kelp forest, it's just the most amazing thing you can see with all the different species hanging on to it and swimming through it. It's just a marine wonderland.
So what do you say to the average American who's kind of bummed out now that they learned about the state of and the plight of the abalone off our coast? So what do you say to people like your daughter who are currently game wardens?
Just keep up the good fight.
Keep the good fight.
Even if you think it's a lost cause, I think that's where you're going with that. I mean, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if we did give up? What are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know for sure what the outcome's going to be.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that humans can heal everything.
Right.
Because Mother Nature is amazing, what she can do. Just be aware of what's going on in our environment and try to do the best we can with the resources we have.
Yeah. The other thing, too, I think is, you know, there's been some speculation that... obviously, there's speculation that climate change is playing a role here, right? And we know that there are some people in the United States who have turned climate change into a political issue and deny it. But for me, that's not the important question. Even the important question of, is it the cause? Even is climate change real? That's not really the important question. The important question to me is, do we want to be spewing pollutants into our air? Do we want to be throwing garbage, you know, into our water and producing methane gas that could warm our atmosphere? Mm-hmm. It's not even an issue of is it, isn't it? It's not a political issue. It's a question of do we want this in our environment? I think the answer is no. We'd prefer it not to be. I don't want to be breathing it. So even if we don't know, why not try? To address the issue and see if that's the answer. I mean, we don't do nothing simply because we don't know. We have some suspicions. It's probably better to act on our suspicions than to ignore it into oblivion. Right. That's just my view. But
and keep the enforcement because, you know, we still have the troops out there. I mean, just because the sports season is closed doesn't stop, as we well know.
Right.
You know, abalone poachers, they're still out there.
Yeah.
Just fighting the fight, just like my team did. We still have a special ops team.
Yeah, still game wardens out there.
Yeah.
Still special agents with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Right.
The key is law enforcement, I think, takes the pressure off and maybe can give species that little extra breathing room they need to make that recovery if they can.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe it was that two or three or four reefs that didn't get poached that might be the comeback.
Yeah, exactly. That one holdout population that's out there.
No, so was our glass full enough there?
I think we've got a half full glass we can close on. I do want to say, Kathy, I knew you my entire, you know, the time that you were working when I was working, I was aware of what you and your unit was doing. I always enjoyed working with you in the field, and I know you have lots of cool stories, not more abalone stories, but also you worked on a lot of caviar issues in California. And I do plan to have you back to talk about a broader discussion of caviar. We've had Sean Carnes on this show to talk about the Russian caviar and the involvement of paddlefish.
Sean's a great guy.
And I would love to get you and Sean on an episode, and we'll talk about caviar issues like across the entire United States and the world, because... Right. There's a lot of species in California and the United States that are impacted. So we're going to have you back. But thank you so much for coming and telling us this story, talking to us about abalone. It's an area that I'm sure very few people know about unless they live in California or South Africa or one of the areas where abalone is found. But I appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us. Thank you very much.
Well, it's easy. It's easy to do this kind of stuff when you're as passionate about it as, I mean, I never lost it after I retired.
I agree.
It's just genetic.
100%. That's why it's so fun to come talk about it with other people who care about it. Yeah. So
well, thanks,
you.
Ed.
And my listeners care about it too. So thank you so much.
Good.
And we'll have you back. As for the rest of us, I don't mean to leave you on a down note about abalone. Keep your spirits up. Keep fighting the good fight. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.